Well, I want to welcome you to Super Bowl Sunday at Central Assembly. I was in a store last night, and there were people there obviously buying stuff for their Super Bowl parties today, and they just look goofy. Now, you know, the Super Bowl has had just a lot of stories that have surrounded it. We've got the story of Peyton Manning, who, of course, grew up in New Orleans, now playing for Indianapolis, his dad, the famous quarterback of the New Orleans Saints. We have all kinds of stories here, but I've grown up sort of being on the side of underdogs. And, of course, the story of New Orleans is a very interesting story. You have a team that has been struggling for years and years. You have a city that was destroyed several years ago by Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, you have the long-suffering fans of this team. They are people who not only called their team the Saints, but called them the Aints. There were actually some years there where they came and attended the games with bags on top of their heads to, they couldn't stand what was going on the field. And, of course, this is the week of crazy marketing of image. It's over-the-top media coverage, costs a lot of money, and it's become, frankly, a national holiday. It's also, I would say, a worship event. It's a worship at the throne of hype and of money. And I think every one of us, as into this as we may be, because it is part of our national psyche, need to acknowledge that sporting winning teams has had a huge influence on our nation. Now, immediately you're going to say, oh, man, this guy is not a fan. Well, I'm a huge fan. You can just ask my family. They don't even want to watch sports with me because I'm so rowdy. I make people mad with the things I say at the television. I, of course, correct every call by every ref. I'm that sort of person. I grew up in Chicago, and, I love the Bulls. I love the Blackhawks. I love the Bulls, the Blackhawks, the Bears. I love the Cubs. And I know what it is to endure teams that lose. The Saints, you know, if you're a Saints fan, you've endured four decades. We've endured a century of bad teams. But, of course, I remember just 10 years ago, it was Missouri's Super Bowl. What a great story that was. Kurt Warner, he had played arena ball. He had played over in Europe. He had stocked, you know, grocery shelves in Des Moines while he's playing arena ball. He gets a shot at the St. Louis Rams. When I came here, I hated the Rams. I hated the Rams because I came from Southern California. They had left Southern California, and they had come to St. Louis. Of all places, St. Louis. I mean, L.A. Rams, I mean, that has a ring to it. St. Louis Rams, that has no ring to it. So, you know, I come the fall of 99, and the story emerges of Kurt Warner. I mean, it's a great story. You know, as sports goes, people get hurt and their backups get a shot. And he took full advantage of that. And the history is, you know, the rest of the story has been told. And of course, this past week, he sort of laid down his cleats. It was the end of his career. But what a glorious career it was. Not only of unbelievable statistics, both with the Rams and then finally with the Cardinals out in Arizona, but just a genuinely good guy. To hear the reports of this guy who was, arguably one of the finest quarterbacks that ever lived. And yet, as you listen to tough, rough, you know, macho guys talking about what a good man he was, about the faith that had, in a sense, inspired him. So we enter into this Sunday that is a national holiday. And I really think that we've got to consider what this is about. It's a national holiday, but it's also a worship event for our nation. It's about sort of over-the-top consumption of experiences that in turn can consume us. The cover of Christianity Today this past week, the new issue, had on the front a bunch of crazy Green Bay Packer fans. It's 35 below outside and they have paint on them and they're out there just sort of yelling and screaming. The name of one of the articles in this particular issue of Christianity Today said this, Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer, a fascinating account of the lunacy that is University of Alabama football. A reporter recounts a conversation with Mr. and Mrs. Reese in their $300,000 motorhome, purchased exclusively to travel to Crimson Tide games. The culprit, turns out, had missed their daughter's wedding because it fell on the same day as the Alabama-Tennessee game. They said they had managed to make the reception and noted that they had asked their daughter not to schedule her wedding on this big game day. Asked why he did it, Mr. Reese could only shake his head and respond, "I just love Alabama football. It's all I can think of." Now, I understand being excited, but one has to pause for a minute at this particular account. And so, this day, this national holiday, this day of exhilaration, I think it's important for us as followers of Jesus to ask some serious questions about ourselves. And ask the question, what does God say about looking out for number one? And I want to take my thoughts this morning from a book that all of you study on a regular basis, the book of Obadiah. Okay? It's in the Old Testament. It's the shortest book in the Old Testament. There are 21 verses, and it's between Amos and Jonah. Okay? And if I were to say, you know, what is the central theme of this particular book and how it speaks to us and critiques us, I would find it in verse 15. Back in the day, we would call the key verse the golden text. We would memorize that. And here is the golden text. Here's the essence of the book of Obadiah. The day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. This is about a relationship that we have with our Creator God. It is about the relationship between Creator and created. And what is necessary between the two is accountability. Now, here's the story. It's not a feel-good story. I can tell you that right now. It is a story that really has a parallel in Jeremiah 49. We know very little about Obadiah, but we know that this story is the continuation of a rivalry between the twin brothers Esau and Jacob. If we were to describe these two guys in Super Bowl parlance, we would say that Esau is a trash-talking middle linebacker. And we would say that Jacob is the guy in the $3,000 suit in the luxury box with an entourage. But what we have here is a nation being called out by God. The nation is called Edom, and Edom is literally the descendants of Esau. And of course, the other historical focal point in this story are the descendants of Jacob in the nation of Judah. Edom is found to the south of the Dead Sea. And if you've ever been to the Holy Land, you would know that one of its famous cities is the city of Petra. It is a city that is carved out, literally out of cliffs. And understanding that will give you an understanding of how God speaks to these people, the nation of Edom. We find in verses 2 through 4 a description of something that God begins to build. He's building his case in this public arena, and he basically is telling us what has shaped the problem. Part of the problem is that they have a self-pride in their geography. You just saw the picture of Petra. You can see their pride. Look what it says here in verse 3. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rocks and make your home on heights. You who say to yourself, who can bring me down to the ground? What had occurred for generations was that the Edomites had, in a sense, become raiders of all those peoples around their area. They would go out and they would pillage the countryside, and as their enemies would chase them, they'd run back into places like Petra, hide, and literally from the cliffs laugh at the people who were chasing them. We also see another part of Edom's sort of cultural understanding of itself, and we see that in verse 8. It says, in that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom, men of understanding in the mountains of Esau. In a sense, this is a culture that not only has prided itself in its geography, but has prided itself in its wittiness. They prided themselves in being wordsmiths. They prided themselves in being able to turn a phrase and to fillet people with words. They built their culture on teaching their children parables. And they were masters of riddles. They were wordsmiths. They had a sophistication in their rhetoric. They had created an art form. This was a national identity. They were the epitome of cool. They were people not only proud of the fact that no one could catch them. They could run, they could do anything they want. Nothing could hold them to accountability because they had the safety of their rock dwellings. And they were also proud of the fact that they were just smarter than everybody else. They were wittier. They could turn a phrase. I mean, they were just plain cool. They could fillet anybody, not only with a sword, but with their words. But God says in verse 7 and 8 that in a sense, your pride has become a trap. That it says at the end of verse 7, those who eat your bread will set a trap for you, but you will not detect it. So here's a group of people, in a sense, who have created a life for themselves. They think they are pretty proud of what they've done. They aren't held to accountability. Nobody's caught them at what they're doing. And they just flat out have lost touch with reality. And God says, you know what? I'm going to call you to accountability, and you won't even detect it when you're about to fall. So frankly, these folks are overrated. They have believed their own press reports for too long. They've gotten out of touch with reality, and God is going to judge them. Now you say, you know what? So far, all I see is a bunch of people who are just sort of jerks. I mean, these are people that just you don't want to be around. People, just avoid them. I mean, just get on with life and let them do what they're going to do. But God says, no, something that you did, which in a sense is as Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. In a sense, this national identity involved these Edomites in something so despicable that God could not let it go. And in verses 11 through 14, you see the picture of that sort of final foundational piece of God's concern and judgment of this nation, Edom. It really is about what happened most likely in about 586 BC when the Babylonians came and pillaged Jerusalem and then took them captive into Babylon. What you see described in verses 11 through 14 is a description of Edom's part in the pillaging of Jerusalem. Now, God is saying to these people, you know what? I know you've had animosities between you and these Judeans, but the bottom line is that your family, God says that you've involved yourself now in the tragedy against your brother Jacob. And then he begins to list off a description of a story that frankly is violent to the core. The early world, the people in this particular Near East area, this is violence beyond words. I mean, even as free as movies might be, I'll tell you, it cannot begin to depict the kind of violence that is described here by the prophet Obadiah. What began as simply joining in a party got out of hand. They stood aloof, he says. That is, the Edomites stood aloof. He said, I mean, your family, how can you let something like this occur? But you stood aloof while these Babylonians carried off wealth of Jerusalem. You should have understood what that meant. That in a sense, these children of mine are being desecrated. They are being carried off into captivity. You stood by. Not only did you stand by, but you joined in the pillaging. And then he goes into a series of things that said, you shouldn't have done this. You should not have. He says, you should not look down on your brother who is hit by misfortune. What you see here is this sort of self-deception of the Edomites. These are people who have just gotten used to dissing other folks. They're just used to just sort of calling people names, laughing at other people, thinking that they were high and mighty, and never being called into accountability. And God says, you know what? Enough is enough. You should not look down on your brother when he's hit by misfortune. You shouldn't rejoice over the destruction of Jerusalem. I mean, they were high-fiving each other. They were excited about the destruction of Judah, and in particular, Jerusalem. What you see here is the beginning of mob violence. And what happens is their hearts sort of get caught up into the moment. He says, you shouldn't boast so much in their trouble. What you have here is a bunch of folks high-fiving each other. And if they had had cell phones, they would be taking pictures of the destruction and placing it on YouTube and calling it cool. That is exactly what is going on here. And God says this stinks to high heaven. He says you shouldn't march through the gate. Not only did they stand around and watch this occur, they got involved. They went into the city itself and participated in the pillaging of the city while helplessness is all around. He said, you shouldn't seize their wealth. Not only did you join in and high-five each other at what the Babylonians were doing, but the bottom line is they took stuff themselves. They were part of the frenzy that is part of this story. And then not only, after it's all done, and the Babylonians have sort of trucked all these people back into captivity, as was in that day. It says here, you should not wait at crossroads. You should not hand over survivors. There were people, obviously, who had hid, who had tried to avoid this tragedy. And here they are, sort of coming out after the storm is over. And here are the Edomites catching them, running after the Babylonians and say, hey, you missed some here. This is one tragic story. Here are people who turn from being just, you know, jerks to being diabolical. And God says, you know what? I can't stand this. And we see in verse 15 then, the golden text, it says, the day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your head. God is saying, you know what? I take this business of the way people treat one another really seriously. I take this kind of animosity and tragedy between nations as really serious stuff. And so between verses 15 and 17, we see a description of the God who metes out his judgment. And the things that we can say about God in this series of verses is we see God as thorough. You can look in verses 5 through 7, 19 and 20, and you see a description here of what God says is going to happen. And literally, it comes to pass. The Edomites as a nation basically vanish into a mist during the period between the last prophet Malachi and the coming of Jesus. At about 400-year period, they vanish. They don't exist. They are gone. He is thorough. What he says would occur happens. But what we also see is a God who is fair. You say, man, that's really judgmental. No, God's fair. He isn't just singling out certain people. He says in verse 15, the day of the Lord is near for all nations. He is basically saying, you know what? I'm the creator, you're the created, and we have a relationship, and it's called accountability. And you can't act as if you can live life by your own rules. Act as if I don't exist and somehow go on your way and think that everything is fine. This is not a feel-good story. This is a calling to our attention of the fact that the God who has created us and the God we say we serve is really serious about being in charge of our lives. We see that he's merciful. We see in this story here that it's not just about meting out judgment. It's about the fact that there is going to come a time and a place in which on the Mount Zion, there will be redemption that comes. And the simple fact here is that we see that God is sovereign as well. He is in charge, and we cannot walk away from accountability simply because we don't acknowledge him. This is not out of sight, out of mind. God is the creator. So 2700 years later, after this occurs, what does that have to say to us this morning on the eve of a national holiday? First of all, I'd say it teaches us that what we own soon owns us. That left unacknowledged, there are certain things in our lives that can become self-destructive. You know, the Reese's in their $300,000 motorhome. I mean, Alabama football is exciting. They won the national championship this year, good grief. I mean, that's exciting stuff. But we see what, in a sense, becomes something exhilarating, becomes something consuming. Second thing I'd say is, I'm into me is not a mantra fit for followers of Jesus. That's a big one. We live in a society that teaches us from the time we're born that it is our right to consume products. And what happens then is you begin thinking that this consumption is your right, that in a sense, if you don't have 10 brands of a certain thing, that you're being deprived. And what that yields then is a life uncritiqued that focuses attention solely on ourselves, and we live our world as if nobody else or no other concern exists. I'm into me is simply not a mantra fit for followers of Jesus. Moses, in his encounter with God after the disappointment of God's people building the golden calf, etc., in Exodus 31 through 33, asks this rhetorical question. He says of God, what will distinguish us from all other people on the face of the earth? That is still a question that has to be in front of every follower of Jesus. What will distinguish us from all other people on the face of the earth? The answer to that is, Moses sort of answered, if your presence doesn't go with us, don't send us up from this place. His presence, his continuing influence in our lives that demonstrates itself in tangible relationships and actions over a protracted period of time. Lastly, we got to ask ourselves this question. What kingdom has rule in our lives? What kingdom has rule in our lives? What really reigns? What really is the center of our lives? Now, you know, you can sort of dismiss this historical example and say, well, that was a nice analogy. No, this really happened historically. This is a true event. But it begs us to realize that if God is concerned about nations, he's concerned about you and me. He is concerned about every one of us, every human being, every man, every woman. He is concerned about the fact that we need to acknowledge the relationship that he desires to have with us. And so the question, who or what kingdom has rule in my life? Who's in charge of my life? What is the center of my life and how I operate? In your bulletin this morning is a reflective reading that comes from James Emery White, found in his book, Serious Times. Here's an excerpt of that. Dr. White says, it's from the depths of the soul that a life most clearly and significantly speaks. Any life-giving water I might offer to those who thirst is drawn from the well of my soul. But there lies the rub. There lies the rub. You see, you might say, you know, those areas of my life that God hasn't taken over, I mean, they aren't extreme like Edom. I mean, Edom was over the top. And you can even say, you know, I'm not quite as zealous as the Reese's and their Alabama football. You know, I just enjoy this stuff. I understand that. I understand that each of us has those areas in our life where we say, hey, you know, I'm sort of on the edge, but boy, this certainly is enjoyable. The problem, of course, is that uncritiqued self-pursuit advances at someone else's expense, and self-deception becomes inevitable. Edom, I mean, do you think they started out planning to pillage Jerusalem? This is a generations-long identity development. These are people who slowly but surely gain a certain perspective on life. They teach their children this. It goes from generation to generation such that the right set of circumstances, which have been left uncritiqued, create the tragedy that is the sacking of Jerusalem by the Babylonians, joined in by the Edomites. I told you this was not a feel-good story. And I think that the thing that it leaves us with, in a day like this where we are excited and consumed with something that is so American, we've got to ask ourselves some questions, and we've got to realize this. Particularly followers of Jesus need to realize this, that God takes who's in charge really seriously. God takes who's in charge really seriously. And there have been people before us who have dealt with this. I mean, David the king in Psalm 63 says, "Thy loving kindness is better than life." Here's a guy who is a great king, a great soldier, a great politician. He is loved by people. They sing songs about him. He has whatever he wants. But in his more honest moments, he has to say, you know what? I have everything in this world. I'm in charge of soldiers. I'm in charge of people's life. Good grief, I'm a king. But when I compare that to what it means to have my life lived under the gaze of Jehovah God, it doesn't compare. That is serious stuff. Another person who I think really gets it, who understands this constant tension between those factors in our lives that we want to control and God's intrusion into our life, is Mary, the mother of Jesus. In Luke chapter 1, we see the story of how she gets involved with the divine destiny of God. She goes over and visits her cousin Elizabeth. And these two ladies are just sort of regular folks wanting to live their life according to the patterns of their culture, get intersected by the divine destiny of a redemptive God. And it's understandable that they would be wondering, what in the world is going on here? But somehow, some way, they are able to calibrate this whole thing. And we see in Luke 1:51, a song that Mary sings to her cousin Elizabeth as they are having this sort of cousin-to-cousin time together. Here's what Mary sings. "He has performed mighty deeds with his arm. He has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts." See that? He has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. "He has brought down rulers from their thrones, but lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servants, Israel, remembering to be merciful." I want to leave you with this morning. It is a word that everyone needs in our life. And that is that God takes who's in charge of your life really seriously. It's not about only his judgment or our accountability to our Creator. It's about the fact that his loving kindness is better than any way we can shape life. It's about the fact that he is the one who wants to construct and rule and guide our lives. And I think it's reasonable for us on this national holiday to say, "Oh God, there is none like you. There is none like you." And in that moment, at the cusp of something that is so American, say, "I know who rules the kingdom of my life. I know who is in charge of my life. I know I'm accountable to that one who has created me and sought me and bought me and sustains me by his redeeming love. Today I will declare, oh God, there is none like you." At this moment, where it is so American to cheer, but realize there is only one true God. Lord Jesus, there are moments like these where we really need to realize, if we haven't in a long while, that we are accountable to you. You have created us for your pleasure. How many times we have created you for our pleasure. We have created you in the way we want you to be, a God who fills in the gaps of our life according to our purposes and our direction. I pray, oh God, this morning that you would critique us. And by your Spirit, I pray you'd go into the very crevices of our lives. And by your Spirit, speak to us in places we have long refused to hear you, where we have long lived life by our own rules. I pray, oh God, that we would realize that these moments are not moments in which you judge us, but you compel us. You compel us to realize that there is more than what we can create. And like David, O Lord, we say, help us to understand that your loving kindness is better than any life we've ever sought for ourselves.